Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down.
Hello, everyone. I'm Patrick Connor, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. Today, we're doing a special episode of the show. I guess every episode is special in one way or another, but especially so, I think, when we do a kind of boxing history-centered episode, and that's what my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler is going to be doing with me today. We're going to be talking about David Tua. Of course, the famous 1990s and 2000s New Zealand heavyweight who at one point challenged for the heavyweight title against Lennox Lewis, unsuccessfully, of course, unfortunately, but nonetheless, a very interesting career. And I was talking with Bryn, and we were kind of trying to figure out what it was we could do, what it was we could talk about. And look, everybody's got a lot of free time. A lot of people are probably going to be listening to podcasts, and I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people also starting up podcasts. But that being said, boxing history is definitely my thing, as it were. Not that it's only my thing, but it's in terms of just me and my personal preferences and what I love to do. Needless to say, boxing history is my thing. So that's why we chose David Tua. I thought it was a great idea and a great opportunity to talk about a fighter like this. And on top of that, it's very easy nowadays to just go to YouTube and to go ahead and dip into the David Tua pool on there. They have all sorts of fights. Needless to say, if you're a boxing fan, you know that already. But you could go and look up just about any David Tua fight that you could find on there, the vast majority of the fights that happened in his career. And a number of his amateur fights are also on YouTube. So easy to follow along as you listen, too, and just kind of breeze through some highlights or go through some videos. I think a very interesting thing about David Tua, and this is something I'm going to bring up to Bryn too. One of the things that for a number of years was kind of attached to David Tua in one way or another, or especially like on boxing message boards, and I'm sure that there was probably some sort of feature on this in The Ring or KO Magazine at some point, but the idea of putting David Tua in with a Mike Tyson, for whatever reason, was just kind of like the boxing fans' opium. The idea of doing that, the idea of putting those two compact punchers, both of whom capable of unleashing some serious punching power in the ring, I guess the idea of those two colliding was just something that it was one of those, like in the especially early 2000s, when boxing message boards were kind of blowing up, there were a handful of topics that would frequently be brought up to the point of being stereotypical or the point of being like a trope. One of them, for instance, was, when is Prince Nassim Hamed coming back? Another one was, when is Ike Ibeabuchi getting out of jail? Because when he gets out of jail, he's taken over the heavyweight division. And these were the kinds of things we used to joke about because they would get talked about very frequently. And another thing that would get talked about very frequently is, when are Mike Tyson and David Tua going to fight? I guess just the idea of it, the mere prospect of it is so tasty that boxing fans just couldn't resist trying to capture the idea of that. Anyway, David Tua, he had his own career, so we can't just kind of constantly refer to him in the context of Mike Tyson and Mike Tyson's fame. David Tua, needless to say, had his own career and his own backstory. And I think that one of the things that I often like to do, obviously, is the kind of history guys go back to the beginning and also try to find things in fighters' stories and the stories of fights that relate to general history or the history of a region or a city or a country. And anyway, I found a number of things. Bryn should be here any minute, by the way, but I found a number of things that I thought were really, really interesting, not only in David Tua's backstory, but I think in the backstory of Samoa and New Zealand, where, of course, David Tua's from Samoa, but was raised in New Zealand. Sip of coffee here. Sorry. It's got to happen. So, I mean, I think ethnically, David Tua obviously is Samoan and Polynesian, and, you know, as far as the larger ethnic group, I suppose you could say. But that being said, I think he also has a particular draw also in New Zealand for that reason, because he fought out of New Zealand for the vast majority of, well, for pretty much his life. Started fighting at about 7 years old. According to him, he started fighting because his dad had put him into the ring. It's a pretty common story. I think we see a lot of fighters, and this is something Bryn and I have talked about at length. The fighter-father relationship, for whatever reason, that's something that's really prevalent in boxing, probably because it's prevalent in life. And boxing is simply just a smaller, you know, slice, kind of a core sample of life. And we've seen a number of those kinds of situations where fighters were perhaps not forced into the ring, but definitely encouraged in a way that was that could be construed as some serious pressure. And that definitely sounds to me like that's what happened with David Tua. And while he sounded and looked like he loved to fight, I think on some level he was probably pushed into it and more than he might have wanted to. But he used to be thrown into the ring with grown men when he was pretty young, according to him. And according to him, if he didn't do well, his dad would be sitting, would be standing right outside the ring, literally with a belt in his hand, waiting to whoop his ass if he didn't do very well against a grown man. That's also actually, I mean, you can kind of make of this what you will, and you can kind of derive whatever social commentary from it that you will. But another common theme in a number of fighters' backstories is that they were at one point or another, when they were young, forced to fight grown men. This is something that, for instance, Jimmy Wilde was pretty well known for having fought a number of much larger opponents when he was pretty young. Of course, a lot of those, according to popular legend and what we know of history, came at the famous boxing booths that traveled around the UK and other parts of Europe. But again, a common theme, having to kind of be forced into the ring with somebody much better, much bigger than you, to toughen you up, as it were. And so that was David Tua's upbringing as a pretty young kid. But going back, actually, some of the things that I found very interesting, as you guys know, on the history shows, I like to take it back and go do my research. I found in a number of articles, actually, in the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a popular newspaper. Speaking of popular, Bryn.
Coronavirus special.
Yeah, we're doing the fucking lockdown history edition. Well, you don't sound locked down. What are you doing?
I'm in Connecticut, locked down, shacked up with a girl I'm dating. So I'm in Stamford, Connecticut, which I don't know at all. Just like moved in with the cat. So time to get to some normalcy, talk some boxing, talk some David Tua.
Well, man, I mean, just as a quick, comment on that, I got to say that it's probably going to be better off in Connecticut or wherever you are, Connecticut, than having to be holed up in an apartment building in New York City. But I don't know. I could be wrong.
No, it is. I mean, that was it's weird because since I've lived in New York City, this is a real throwback to Vancouver. I mean, and you're in Portland. I don't know how centrally located you are in Portland, but everybody says Portland is like the sister city of Vancouver, but this is really like going into residential Vancouver, which itself is a very provincial residential city. So it's odd to like wake up and walk out onto the sidewalk and there's no people and endless space and trees and, you know, besides this clusterfuck thing going on that's probably going to last for months and months. It's, you know, other than this massive fire engine going on right now, it's been pretty peaceful. So it's, I don't know, it's a very surreal setup. It's hard to wrap your mind around that every restaurant is closed. People are keeping 6 feet from you when you walk by them. Like, it's a very weird reality that seems that sometimes viscerally going on, and at other times there is that feeling of a snow day. I mean, what is it like for you where you are?
Well, I'm just across from... Holy shit, dude. Hopefully everything's okay. Holy fuck. Damn, it seems like, dude, like the rescue and respond, the first responders follow you wherever you go, man. That is like the... It ain't Red Jonathan Butler if there ain't sirens in the background, dude. It's fucking
okay,
it's
well,
magical.
I don't know that I deserve all the credit for that. I think New York City primarily does, but in Stamford, Connecticut, I think that's going to be more anomalous than not. But yeah, I get New York City. I mean, what is New York City reduced to its essence? Taxi cabs, airplanes, emergency vehicles.
I'm walking here. Yeah, pretty much. That's about it.
Pretty much.
Now we're just across the river. We're just across the big river, the Columbia River, from Portland in Vancouver, Washington, which is, you know, we're more or less in Portland. But it's not a tiny city. I want to say it's probably like 200,000 or something like that in Vancouver here. So it's not a tiny city. It's pretty decent size. But no, most things are on lockdown. Most things are shut down. My wife, who works in the veterinary field, has not yet been fully, you know, contained, but that will happen at some point soon. Right now, we're okay, and luckily, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I'll just simply say that I kind of had a feeling that some shit was about to be going down, and so a few weeks ago, we literally filled our fucking freezer in our garage with protein and bread and a few other things, and then stocked up the refrigerator and freezer inside, stocked up the pantry, got a bunch of shit, got extra toilet paper, all that stuff. So as far as all of that, we're totally fine, and I'm not really very worried about all of the financial stuff per se. I mean, it sucks, and it's very anxiety-inducing, but at the same time, I can definitely tell people that they're not going to systematically go and remove literally fucking everybody from their houses because, you know, nobody's going to be able to afford rent or mortgage or anything. So it's going to be so widespread they just won't be able to do anything about it. So that being said, you know, it just kind of, it is very surreal. It's very bizarre. But it's also a situation where as vapid as a thing as this is to say, you can't do anything about it. There's nothing we can do about it except for do what we can to help other people. So that is essentially all that, you know, we're just kind of batting down the hatches. We're ready to ride it out as much as we can and talk some motherfucking boxing, man.
I think that's true. I mean, I'd be very curious what kind of protein you have. Like, are you a whey-based guy or... is it a flavor-based thing? You're trying to get root beer protein, which I can appreciate.
Man,
I want protein powder.
Nah, I don't mess with any of that. Although I did recently start working out again. But we have pork is like dirt cheap up in the Pacific Northwest. Why? Don't know. Don't care. It's delicious. So we have a ton of pork in the freezer. That's the kind of protein I'm talking about. It's delicious. But... all right, protein, getting back to the boxing.
Yep.
I was just saying, though, like, so every time I, you know, do the history thing, I like to take it back as far as I can. And, you know, look in newspapers and shit like that, if I can, if I have time, because I will get lost and it will distract the hell out of me. But I did, and I was able to find a number of articles pretty far back from the Sydney Morning Herald on newspapers.com. And so, luckily, if you go on to BoxRec, the guys at Box and girls at BoxRec, the people at BoxRec, are, you know, they're pretty hardworking. They do a lot of shit, a lot of cataloging. And now if you click on a fighter's profile or whatever, their wiki, whatever you want to call it, on BoxRec, often they will have what they can find of their amateur career. And so you can see some of the stuff from David Tua's amateur career. But I was able to go all the way back into almost 1988. And David Tua was a small, light heavyweight at that point. And in, you know, in 1988, he would have been what? Let me do some quick math here. He was born in 72. Oh, so he would have been only, you know, 16 years old. Pretty young dude. In 1990 was when he really got any sort of international coverage as far as, you know, getting outside of the New Zealand, Australia region. And that was, of course, something I figured you would probably bring up when he wound up going as an amateur to the World Championships in Sydney and eventually losing, I think, in the second round to good old Felix Savon.
First round. I think it was a first-round knockout, wasn't it?
I meant like the second round of the tournament.
But oh, yeah.
Second.
No, I mean, that is something to bring up when people discuss the viability, I think, of Savon as a heavyweight is who the fuck did. I mean, Lennox Lewis didn't do that to David Tua when Lewis was in his prime, and Savon just fucking flattened him like an animal getting a kill shot. Like it was like a shot in the head. It was, Tua, I thought it was a fun one for us to discuss today. Cause I mean, he's just such an interesting case of a very intriguing career, fought a lot of big name guys, has like the biggest punch output ever in a heavyweight fight against the president, Ike Abiyebuchi. And then spending some time with Ronnie Shields when he was Rigondeaux's trainer, I think he still is. Shields had trained Tua for a while and said he was the laziest fighter he ever worked with. So there's a lot of what ifs about who Tua could have been had he stayed in the kind of shape that had that tremendous knockout against the quiet man, John Ruiz, at that showcase of heavyweights that HBO put on. So there's tons of material, I think, with Tua. Interesting sort of Tyson mold guy, but then just becomes so large, like early in his career, he's fighting at 250, 260, and he's a guy who probably at best is 5'10". Fighting these monsters who are out there. He's fascinating.
Ian, so one of the things that, you know, if you go back, and there are a number of articles, especially from the late 90s and early 2000s, if you Google hard enough, you know, it doesn't really take that much these days, but the vast majority of people are not going to go through that effort. And I get it, but hey, dude, that's why we're here, to do that for you. And so if you go through some of this shit, David Tua talks about how he got started in boxing, and I kind of was bringing this up briefly a minute ago before he got on, but so he talks about how he was more or less pushed into boxing, perhaps literally, by his dad when he was about 7, and that when he was pretty young, he was forced to fight guys that were much bigger, stronger, older. And I was also talking about how, number one, the kind of father-son relationship is a common theme in boxing. And number two, also how this it's a kind of a common theme in boxing to be considered a tough guy when you're young, to be put in with a fucking grown man and just being told to, like, fend for yourself, which is, you know, somewhat sociopathic, but okay. Mm. And, you know, nonetheless, I think that, and this is just my dime store psychology here. I, you know, took some community college psychology here, so that makes me an expert. But I would imagine that is the kind of situation that would probably make you hate boxing, that would probably make you not really want to do it. Or, you know, like we've talked about, and I don't want to draw Mike Tyson into the conversation too much, but it's relevant in the sense that Mike Tyson has brought up that he fought because he was scared, not because he loved to fight per se. And I think that that's something yep. that, you know, it's something that it's a really fine line, and it's a really fine line for him, Mike Tyson, to have walked, admittedly, and for him to openly talk about that. It was a fine line that he would be angry and, you know, want to kill something or somebody, but not because he was angry, like not because of the anger came out of anger alone, but because it came out of fear. And I think yeah. that I'm not necessarily saying David Tua was fearful or afraid, but just that perhaps it sounds like, especially when you factor in this, you know, he didn't really like to train and wasn't really into it in that sense, that maybe he didn't really love it because of how he was pushed into it. And, you know, it was said, at least according to him, that he used to, when he was fighting these much larger opponents, his dad used to be literally standing outside the ropes with a belt in his hand if he didn't do well. So there you are, a young child. I don't know how old this particular anecdote came from, but I don't know, let's say 12. I mean, I'm thinking of me when I was 12, perhaps, being put in with a grown man, and then first of all getting your ass kicked by the grown man, and then on top of that, stepping outside the ring and then getting punished with a belt because you got your ass kicked by a grown man. Wow. I mean, when you kind of put it like that, it's a little weird.
And I think that's a really important thing to say. I think the conception is most fighters jump into it because they love to fight. They're violent, the kind of Joyce Carol Oates pop psychology without a lot of experiential material that she's drawing from, is that these guys are all acting out repressed aggression that they would otherwise bring on society. But fortunately, it's in the safe environment of the ring. And that's not really true of almost any fighters that I met in boxing gyms or that I've met covering the sport either. And I would add to your credentials also, let's remember, when Bloomberg was on the hunt for a boxing historian, I believe, are you the same Patrick Connor that they went to solicit some material about boxing history?
I'm sure it was.
Well, one of the most prestigious business magazines out there has, you know, conferred on you that when they seek out a boxing historian, there's one man that they go to, the unofficial Bloomberg boxing historian. I think that should be in your resume.
Well, if I want to be, as a boxing historian, if I want to be backed by somebody, I'm telling you right now, I want to be backed by the guy who spent 900 million or billion or however the many fucking dollars to not become president.
Yeah, me too. But yeah, no, I think that's totally true of Tua. I think he is, there are a number of examples of boxers who achieved greatness because they were always in shape, always driven. Mayweather being the most obvious example, Andre Ward, I think Roy Jones was that really until losing the weight after Tarver just really fucked with his system where he just couldn't ever return to the guy that we knew prior to the first Tarver fight. But Tua was somebody who always struggled with discipline. Tyson was the same way. Tyson, I remember hearing rumors, and yet I never saw pictures of it, sort of pre-internet, of him blowing up 50 pounds between fights, having these crash diets between fights. And I was like, is that true? Or are those like apocryphal rumors? Because he always looks in such immaculately great shape prior to sort of post-prison Tyson, not the original post-prison Tyson, who was as ripped as I've ever seen him, but the body changed. He was sort of routinely coming in heavier and heavier. But he was somebody that always battled his weight. He was a very, by his own account, a very fat kid, and boxing was a way to kind of get in shape. I mean, he was superhuman strong, probably like Tua, prodigiously strong guy. But it is interesting, these guys who are very undisciplined, who just have so much ingrained talent that they're able to draw from, but the discipline is not, if it's not consistent, these guys really do struggle at the elite level most of the time. I mean, even where the guys have the dialed in discipline, they struggle anyway, but you're just handicapping yourself so tremendously if even to be in shape for fights is itself a battle. And it seems like it was one for Tua probably his entire career, more so than Tyson. I mean, early Tyson was always in, you know, always 216, 217, showing up in shape. But in between fights, everybody around him knew the longer the delay, the more trouble this guy's going to get into, the less ability he's going to have to stay focused. And it's intriguing just to do a deep dive into somebody where focus was a battle in and of itself. And Tua is a prime example of that. Like I was saying at the beginning of the what ifs, had he been somebody who had sort of Andre Ward's mentality of always being in the best shape and condition he could possibly be in for every fight, we might be talking about a very different career. Maybe, maybe somebody that could have won a lot of these big fights that he came out on the losing end. I mean, he was never stopped against a lot of elite competition, but he was certainly willing to fight anybody and did fight a lot of huge names and gave them some tough contests. But discipline was definitely something that dogged him throughout his career.
Yeah, I don't, speaking of walking a fine line, you know, in regards to him keeping in shape, I'm just going to say, historically, the Polynesian people are not an overly skinny people.
No, that's a fair, I think that's a fair generalization.
Okay, just making sure. I could have gone the Samuel Jackson in, you know, Pulp Fiction route, but I was not gonna do it. But seriously, yeah. I mean, you could see also even as a younger guy, the Felix Savon David Tua fight is on YouTube, so you can go look it up super easy. But I think that you can also kind of just see in there he would have been about 17 or 18 at the time. First of all, it's really difficult to really take much from that fight result at this juncture, because first of all, it's Felix Savon, who is easily one of the greatest amateur heavyweights of all time. And I mean, when you're one of the greatest Cuban amateurs of all time, that's, you know, even just in and of itself saying something. But as a heavyweight, he was a big guy. He was a strong guy, particularly skilled. And at this point, David Tua actually had just been just made the move to heavyweight. I was talking about, you know, seeing some of his older articles. And so back in 1989, you know, we're talking about light heavyweight, 81 kilos, light heavyweight, 81 kilos. And then it goes to late 1990, 91 kilos. He's barely hitting 200 pounds in 1990. And so this is exactly when he fought Felix Savon. So again, don't want to read too much into this at this point and overanalyze it, but we literally are talking about a grown man and a much bigger grown man too versus a pretty young man and a guy who just got to heavyweight. So
sorry to interrupt, but and this is a constant criticism that Cuban fighters get, and I think it always misses out on a key point. But here it's true. Savon was 5 years older than Tua when he knocked him out, which is a big difference from their respective ages. Like, Savon was a full man.
Especially the amateurs.
And especially in the amateurs. And we were talking earlier also about Samoans. They have a propensity, it seems, to be large. But on the other hand, you have the New Zealand All Black fullback in rugby, Jonah Lamu, was one of the greatest athletic specimen that I've ever seen in my life. He was somebody who could run an Olympic 100 meters, and he was 6'5", 250 pounds or something, and 20, and didn't practice sprinting. They produce these people that are some of the world's greatest genetic freaks of athletic accomplishment.
Well, and I mean, that goes literally... I can't say evolutionarily why. I cannot say physiologically why. I truly have no idea exactly how so many Polynesian people developed so powerful. But that's really what we're talking about, is we're talking about power and force, raw force generated. And a guy an extremely fast rugby player who is that size, I just, the amount of force they can generate in a hit is tremendous. And the same thing for David Tua. When he started kind of filling out, as it were, even as a younger kid, you could see that his legs are fucking massive. But when he started filling out, I mean, his legs are just like almost grotesquely large. I mean, just, oh my God. And then you can see the type of power he's getting into that hook. So against Felix Savón, a lot of inexperience, and you could tell where they were on like on the different levels of experience, because you have David Tua charging in at a guy like Felix Savón, which is just it's a poor strategy, period. But then on top of that, trying to double up a left hook, a lazily double up a left hook against a guy like Felix Savón, who just goes boop and catches him with the right hand like it was nothing, and David Tua's legs are gone. But even then, you know, you can see that his legs are big, and when he finally starts kind of filling out, the type of power he generates from those legs is, again, just grotesque. It's crazy. You could literally go through his career pretty much on YouTube, even a number of his earlier fights from Australia and I think a handful in New Zealand, a number of them are on YouTube, and he's like barely landing on these guys. Some of them are scrubs, of course, but he's barely landing on these fools and just putting them to sleep. It's like, holy hell, dude. It's gnarly. And so to have that kind of raw ability and raw power where, like, he doesn't even really have to try when he's throwing these punches to knock a grown man out that's pretty crazy. And so that also figures into that equation of kind of taking it for granted and perhaps not working as hard as he otherwise would have if he did not have that kind of raw ability. Where, you know, this is the conversation with boxing quite often, where it's that push and pull between having just enough ability to do it, but not so much that you get lazy and you rely on the ability, but also having that drive, the motivation, you know, those intangibles, and that combination of those things is rare. It's not easy to find.
No, and I think, like, a big difference, if you're looking at what chiefly distinguishes Tyson from Tua, is Tyson's knockouts early in his career. It's the footwork that's so exceptional, that's setting up these openings and these angles to catch people where the chin is open in ways, you know, he's switching stances, he's just creating angles in a way that we've not really seen any heavyweight do. I don't think we ever have seen a heavyweight kind of create the angles that early Tyson had. Tua is not an example of that. I mean, Tua's legs were much bigger than Tyson's, and Tyson had big legs. I mean, he was a very low body, strong person, but Tua was just your example of just brutal, raw strength and some good hand speed, but I mean, he's just leaping at guys. It's not Tyson finding, you know, these D'Amato shifts and finding these unorthodox angles and pressure counterpuncher. Tua really wasn't a counterpuncher. He was a puncher from the beginning and a brawler, had a tremendous chin that he was well aware could take punishment to deliver blows. And as you say, very few heavyweights could sort of tap people with stuff, even through the guard. You want an example of this, like, watch the Michael Moore fight. Granted, I don't think it was the best prepared Michael Moore, but a Moore who could just go to war with guys and got up from tremendous shots. Watch Bert Cooper, who we've talked about before, Evander Holyfield, beat the shit out of George Foreman until he was stopped round after round after round. He was just killing Foreman. Tua just taps him like it's fucking over to bed for, you know, it looked like he fell asleep for a week sort of thing. I mean, Tua was very, very special with what he brought to the table, but not the most well-schooled fighter by any means, and not a, you know, a technical virtuosity by any stretch either.
Yeah, it's that I remember watching that Michael Moore fight and thinking at the time that it looked kind of suspect, but then now in hindsight, I think Michael Moore was just, he was so hot and cold, you know, like he was so, he was difficult to really figure as far as whether or not you were going to get a full effort out of him and whether or not he trained properly. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that David Tua was a scary-ass David Tua, the kind of guy who was not afraid to corner an opponent and just pummel the shit out of him. And another example of him doing that is he actually, and this was another fight that I remember watching live and just being so thankful that he got the win against Frezza Kendo. Now, Frezza Kendo hasn't even fought in, like, I don't even know. I'd have to look. I'm not sure. But he is still holds some sort of ranking or some sort of, like, I don't even know what it is. You'd have to ask Dan Rayfield because he brings it up somewhat frequently. But he, Frezza Kendo holds some sort of status in, like, the WBA or some shit like that. And I remember David Tua fighting Frezza Kendo and just, like, struggling for however many rounds it was to catch this dude and just running after him, not really being able to find him. And finally kind of catching him with a shot enough that wobbled Frezza Kendo, but that wasn't the scary part. The scary part was what followed up. Because the camera angle was the camera angle that happened to be just behind Frezza Kendo's head as David Tua is, like, coming at him. And so Frezza Kendo's against the ropes, and the camera's right behind his head, and you could just see David Tua, like, almost, like, curling up into a ball before he started unleashing right hands, not even left hooks. And it's, like, it's some of the scariest shit you'll ever see in your life. You couldn't make a movie about it. So I recommend going and looking that up on YouTube. There. Like, it's, I think, just a snapshot of the kind of power he could generate, you know, in his prime, as it was. So,
I think also, like, there's some parallels with Joe Frazier and Tua. I mean, they both have this tremendous left hook, but I think Frazier was kind of famous for not being able to tie his shoes with his right hand, and as you can tell with, I think, the shot that put away Michael Moore, Tua did have a right hand. He was a two-handed puncher. Left hook, I think, was a more dangerous weapon. But if you just went in there crazily trying to protect yourself from that, he could certainly take you out with that sweeping right hand he had as well. I mean, he was just a tremendous puncher and a voluminous puncher, as we, you know, we'll get to with Ike Biabucci. But this is a guy, when he was in reasonably good shape, had unbelievable stamina to just keep coming and coming and coming, trying to take your head off really for like 2 minutes out of every round. He was capable of fighting in that style, that kind of pressure style. So he was thrilling to watch. Jesus.
And actually, this is something that I had brought up before you hopped on, because I figured, you know, I just kind of briefly mentioned it because I figured that there was something that you would want to talk about. But I remember back in the day, being the early 2000s or so, boxing message boards were kind of blowing up, and that was the main form of communication between boxing fans. I mean, chat rooms, I guess, but it wasn't really the right demographic for that. And message boards fit. And so I remember that there were a handful of topics that would come up frequently to the point of, like, we would mock the topic, like, when is Prince Nassim Hamed coming back? And the answer was pretty much never. You know, when is Ike Abeabuchi getting out of prison so he can rule the heavyweight division? And the answer was, like, that ain't fucking happening, guy. But nonetheless, these things kept popping up. And another thing that kept popping up is, you know, when is David Tua going to fight Mike Tyson? When are they going to fight? It was just that kind of, like, mouth-watering matchup that it's like, you know, one guy who hits hard as shit against another guy who also hits hard as shit, and if you unleash them at each other in the ring, something crazy is going to happen. Why? When can we get that? When's that going to happen? And, like, what do you think, dude? Like, what is... what would have happened in, let's say, 1999, if they would have fought in, like, 1999?
I mean, I think both of them have really impressive chins. Let's see. I mean, Tua is 6 years younger than Tyson, so we're talking, you know, 27-year-old Tua versus a 33-year-old Tyson. I think a lot of it with Tyson at that time was really not that focused on boxing, like, clearly had lost everything that made him a great fighter and had become a puncher. So, you know, instead of being that pressure counterpuncher that he was early on, and if they're just punching, I think Tua had the power to put away Tyson. You know, I think And I think that Tyson recognized that if he really wasn't anybody who put Tyson on his back foot, beat Tyson in his career, right? Am I wrong about that? Is there anybody who, if they put him on his back foot, came out on the losing end of a fight? I don't think so.
No, I think that that's, maybe an oversimplification, but also true. You know, all I mean is that I think it's a little bit more complex than that, in the sense that, like, I think that there was kind of a, and you'd probably agree, there was a, like, a psychological element to it, not just being able to kind of physically push him back, because Peter McNeely, you know, managed to, for 30 seconds, push him back. It just didn't do anything. You know, but there was kind of like, and but I mean, the difference here being that, at least ostensibly in our imaginations, if Mike Tyson lands his Sunday punch against David Tua in the first 30 seconds, minute of a fight, that he's going to be okay, that he's going to take it okay. And that would, that's the problem. That's the kind of turning point, I think, where if you're not bowing to Mike Tyson, if you're not in there going, holy shit, I'm fighting Mike Tyson, like, you know, that's I think where it changes.
Well, and I think, like, let's look at that, because 1999 Tyson is both, that's after both losses to Holyfield. That's Franz Botha, Orland Norris Tyson. So we're talking like a pretty shitty version of Tyson at that time. Like, that's going into Savarese and Galata and Brian Nielsen. So if we're comparing that to where Tua was in 1999, that's 2 years after, well, really a year and a half after Ike Iwobuchi. It's not really any, I guess there's the Haseem Rahman knockout that he had. That's in 98. Shane Sutcliffe, I think from British Columbia. So shout out to Shane Sutcliffe. Miss you. Love you. yeah, leading up to Lennox Lewis, which was at the end of 2000. I think that's a hell of a good fight. I mean, I think that that's going to be a war where both guys are going to be tested. Probably both guys are going to get dropped. I have a lot of respect for Tyson's chin, and I think, you know, he's out of pride at that point. Like, he was getting up against Lennox Lewis. He took a fucking savage beating at the hands of Lennox Lewis when they fought a few years after this would have happened. So I think it's a great time for that fight, and I think it's a bit of a pick'em, frankly. I don't know that I would bet against the David Tua who just come off, like, not long before the Iwobuchi fight. Does that guy beat Tyson? Probably. Probably, like, that version of Tyson I would favor Tua against. I mean, am I way off on this? Or, like, what's your sense of it?
No, I think that you're calling it pretty close, man. I mean, I think that it's I think that that's beyond just the power versus power, you know, hammer house versus hammer house type of guy. Their type of matchup, I think, beyond that, which is also, it's very potent. It definitely kind of appeals more to the id, more to the base level of being a boxing fan or a fan of violence or just somebody who sits there and watches that shit, which is pretty much everybody. But beyond that, yeah, there are a lot of X factors, a lot of intangibles, a lot of different ways that it could kind of play out, that it's also an interesting fight because it's not just power versus power, and they're not the same kind of fighter at all, really. You know, Mike Tyson, a guy who relied largely, like you said, on speed and relied on his footwork and positioning to land punches in combination, whereas David Tua was more the kind of guy who was physically pushing you back to, you know, walk you into his left hook or right hand. And, you know, it's a different approach, even though it seems very similar, the different approach. So, yeah, it's a very intriguing fight. I think especially in, like, 1999, a lot of people weren't really sure how dedicated Tyson was to boxing. He probably wasn't even sure how dedicated he was to boxing. This is, you know, right around the time he was testing positive, and hell, dude, a lot of people thought that Franz Botha was doing very well in that fight. Well, I don't even need to qualify that or hedge it by saying a lot of people felt he was doing well in that fight until Tyson stepped up and landed that, you know, punched with him and landed that shot that just was one of the hardest shots Tyson's ever landed in his career, straight up. So I ain't going to fault Franz Botha for not being able to take that shot. He just shouldn't have put himself in the position to, you know, eat it. Nonetheless, Mike Tyson was clearly a beatable guy at this juncture, and it was only 2.5-3 years later that Lennox Lewis was snacking on his ass for lunch. So, anyway, yeah, it's tough to say, but something you and I have talked about, I don't remember exactly when or in what context, but I know we've touched on it. How much do you lend credence, you know, to the idea that Ibea Fujitsua fight may have been what pushed Ibea Bucci, you know, psychiatrically, psychologically over the edge, as it were? Because it sounds like, from what I can tell and from what I've read, Ibea Bucci was kind of a strange dude in general. Like, he was just kind of a weird guy who had strange mannerisms and, you know, that type of shit. But then after that fight seemed to worsen. I mean, it's anecdotal and it's from, you know, kind of second and third hand type of, you know, sources. But anyway, I know you and I have talked about it, but do you lend much to that at all?
I certainly don't think it helped his personality or his proclivity towards, what was it, like locking up a prostitute or beating up a prostitute. I mean, yes, he was definitely conservatively putting it, like a deranged personality. But I mean, that is one of the epic heavyweight fights that I've ever seen. I mean, it's one of the most rewatchable too. It's like five heavyweight action fights in one, and these guys just both have so much power and stamina and just volume punching, and most of it fucking landing. I mean, just standing in front of each other, huge puncher. I mean, Ibeabuchi, he's one of the great what-ifs that boxing, I think, has ever had. I mean, just what a specimen that guy was. Watch his Chris Bird fight land one of the great uppercuts kind of hooks I've ever seen. Just kind of had everything that you would ever want in a heavyweight, except he was just batshit crazy before long. No question. I think you could argue that, like, was Tua the same fighter after that fight? They both just beat the hell out of each other. And
so, a fair question. Yeah.
Yeah. And no, I mean, I think Ibeabuchi was definitely an unstable personality, but to what extent did the damage that he incurred in that fight contribute to his legal problems? And I spent most of the last 20 years incarcerated. Like, I mean, a really, really scary guy. But boy, what a career that guy could have had. Jesus, he was so scary to see what he could do against Bird and Tua.
And fair to note, too, that against Chris Bird, you know, he wound up kind of having to save that fight from the fire, as it were. Like, he had to chase Chris Bird around for a number of rounds and was having a really tough time doing it, and then finally got Chris Bird on the ropes and landed the shot that he needed in a fight that was kind of frustrating. But, you know, it's... Yeah, I don't really – I obviously couldn't say for sure whether or not that fight ruined Ike or made him worse or anything. But it certainly did not help. Yeah, didn't seem to help. One of the things, though, that I actually in rewatching the fight, in rewatching the Lennox Lewis versus David Tua fight, I remember at the time, so that fight was a few days before my 18th birthday, and I remember watching the fight at the time, and I was so sure. I actually liked Lennox Lewis. Like, we talked about Lennox Lewis a little bit more at length before, but I used to be a pretty good-sized Lennox Lewis fan. I liked Lennox Lewis, whereas most, you know, American Fight fans just weren't really a fan because of his personality, didn't really like the fact that he was more of like a kind of stand-up one-two fighter. You know, used his height to his advantage in the sense that he'd drape over opponents and stuff like that. So a lot of American Fight fans didn't really like him. I liked him. But despite that, I don't know why I was so sure that David Tua was going to knock him out. I don't know why I was so sure that he was. But I remember betting my brother before my birthday that David Tua was going to win, and my brother was like, no, dude, you're tripping. Lennox Lewis is going to school his ass. And I remember, you know, totally being taken in by the there were like pre-fight photo shoots that David Tua had done. He'd done like a few video segments and stuff like that. I think that part of it was really playing up the spectacle of it all. But also, I guess that I just thought it was cool as shit. But David Tua had done a number of these kind of promotional events and things like that where he was dressed up in traditional Samoan like wrap. I can't remember what they're called, but regardless, he was dressed up and he was like flanked by like women dressed in some kind of ceremonial, or you know, at least what I'm assuming is ceremonial garb, almost to the point where it looked like it was probably played up, obviously. But and then at the weigh-in, they had a face-off, and Tua was getting all huffy and like yelling at him and screaming and shit, and I was like, holy hell, this guy's gonna fucking kill him. And of course, you go back and watch the fight, and it's far more tame than Tua would probably have you believe. But I think it's the third round, I believe. I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while. But one thing that I do like to bring up when I talk about that fight is that David Tua did send Lennox Lewis to the corner a little wobbly in one of those rounds. He caught him with a really good shot right at the end of the round, and they didn't even really pick up much on it. But if you watch, Lennox Lewis kind of like wobbles to his corner like, holy shit, like he caught me. And it just never, nothing ever came of it. And just for that moment alone, though, I was just like, oh, almost. Didn't quite get there.
Well, and let's remember though as well, because like back to what we began with Tua and the discipline and weight trouble, the Tua who fought Lennox Lewis weighed in at 245 pounds. This is like a 5'9" guy with really short reach, who's 245 pounds. Like his fucking BMI is way over qualifying for obese. So, like, this is not an optimal David Tua. This is not the same guy who fought Abiyabuchi 3 years before. So it was already quite a different David Tua who still, you know, like, yeah, he lost by a wide margin against Lennox Lewis. We're talking about a 6'5", 240-pound, lean, one of the great heavyweights ever, if not, you know, arguably the great heavyweight ever, with what he accomplished over the course of his career. But it was already a different Tua. It was like the Tua who fought Abiyabuchi, I think you could argue, kind of stopped there. You know, that was 25-year-old David Tua who fought Abiyabuchi for his first professional loss. And sort of like Tyson, you know, never really developed into a better fighter than that guy who fought that night. You know, and I mean that in the sense of where Tyson after Spinks, where he's 22 years old, never got better after that. He never improved past age 22 for the duration of his career, the remaining fucking 18 years of his career.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that one thing also that we haven't really brought up in this conversation, and I mean, it's not really something that I like to focus on all that much of the non-participants, as it were, like the managers and trainers and stuff like that, but I think also another story of David Tua's kind of like early 2000s career was his relationship with trainer Kevin and manager Kevin Barry. And I'm not sure if like, you know, if you're a boxing fan, you've probably heard the name Kevin Barry or know of it or something like that. But perhaps before this, Kevin Barry was the guy that was best known before, you know, becoming a trader, was best known for being the guy who beat, quote unquote, beat Evander Holyfield in the 84 Olympics. Yeah, in the 1984 Olympics by DQ, because Evander Holyfield landed a shot on the break that was pretty borderline, but hurt Kevin Barry and then was disqualified for it. And, you know, he was a pretty good fighter in his own right. It was just that that was what he was best known for because it was, you know, an injustice. But David Tua had a fairly strained relationship. Well, no, that's probably putting it lightly. He had a very strained relationship with Kevin Barry in the early 2000s and wound up having to – his career pretty much ended in court, as a number of fighters' careers have, where they wind up waiting out a contract and not fighting because they sign a contract with a manager or promoter or whomever, and then for whatever reason want out of the contract, but they can't just get out of the contract. So they wind up having to just wait out the contract, and then their career suffers for it. And that's pretty much what happened to David Tua. Like, the last time he fought was in, like, 2012 or 2013 or something like that, which he had really no business fighting, and he's pretty much just was just a guy there to absorb punches and maybe land a big punch. But, that was kind of the story with how his career petered out.
Yeah, I think there was a behind the scenes. He was just never a stable person on any level, and not that he was getting into trouble, just seemed like, as you were saying, you know, if you're kind of forced into something and your heart is never really in it, you happen to be very good at it to make it look easy. I mean, almost sort of, he seemed kind of like a Babe Ruth sort of figure, where it was just like, it was just ridiculous what he was doing. Those knockouts were sort of like Ruth home runs in a way. It just looked so effortless. Like, this left hook was just there from birth. But
it's like a bowler,
yeah,
it's like not really an athlete, but they could do some impressive shit, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I remember, like, I was always fascinated by Tua, because he was just so exciting and, you know, dramatic fights, but always seemed to come out on the losing end, like just never quite was able to sort of seal the deal and win a piece of the heavyweight title. But I think he was one of the first people I talked to Shields about in terms of who he trained, and Shields trained fucking everybody. And he said, like, he was a brilliant talent. There was a lot of potential there, but easily the laziest fighter that he'd ever trained was how he sized him up. And he didn't say it with malice or anything. It wasn't sort of so that I would go public with it or, you know, try and demean Tua in any way. It was just a recognition of kind of that's what I was working with. In the same way, frankly, like we were talking earlier about Tua knocking out Michael Moore, Freddie Roach, I asked him, did you ever work the corner of a fighter who was not ready? And he said, once, and I'll never do it again. And it was Michael Moore in the David Tua fight. He just said, I absolutely knew that Michael Moore had no business going into the ring that night. It wasn't to excuse this is what Michael Moore wanted to do. It wasn't trying to take away or denigrate David Tua's accomplishment in taking out somebody like Michael Moore, like somebody of his stature, but it was just recognition, like, this guy had no business getting into the ring against like a fierce puncher like Tua. So some of these guys are like that, you know, we don't always know the backstories going in. I mean, could Andy Ruiz Jr. get an opportunity, like seizing the opportunity like he did against Joshua? How could you not train for the rematch? How could you seriously come in heavier and not in shape, and in the moment after you lose be like, well, I'm not going to let this happen again. Next time, there probably won't be a next time. Like, where did Buster Douglas go after Evander Holyfield? There were no more big multi-million dollar paydays, let alone $24 million paydays. We have all of this historical evidence to tell you what you have to be doing at a minimum. And most people just who were not disciplined, who kind of got lucky, they don't do so well. Like, that's why they are aberrations. Like, the big secret is that these people who succeed generally are so maniacally disciplined with their work ethic that these guys don't break through. But I mean, if a Tua had like Andre Ward's mental toughness, I wonder what he could have accomplished. And I mean, if he had been an actual natural heavyweight sized guy, not like a blown up light heavyweight, which Ali used to always criticize Joe Frazier about, like thinking about Frazier in today's heavyweight landscape, you're like, it's a 5'10 guy with like 70 inch reach who's 200 pounds and kind of chubby, you know, like never ripped when he's fighting. How would he have done against Lennox Lewis? I think he would have been knocked out in two rounds.
Dude, you're literally describing me.
Maybe I'm being unfair about it, but I just mean the modern heavyweights when you meet them.
No, but that's what I'm saying is that like it's like saying, hey, Patrick Connor, like go fight Lennox Lewis, and I'm like, bro, I'm 5'10 and like chubby. The fuck?
Yeah, it's well, and I mean, that was the first thought I had when I met Felix Sabone. Was thinking, like, if I was David Tua and 200 pounds and, like, a teenager fighting this guy who looks I don't know how exactly to formulate it, but Sabone is clearly an advanced prototype of an athlete. Like, he is beyond what most human beings are. I don't mean this in any kind of racist way. I just mean everything about him is just screaming, whatever I would do in the realm of, I am the best design you could ever have. I'm bigger, I'm stronger. I get, you know, his jaw, every facet of him was just, what the hell am I looking at? Like his fist was two of my fists. His jaw was carved out of steel. You know, even like a middle-aged Sabone, his bicep was just like a bowling ball, like a huge bowling ball. Clearly he was not working out. It was just, wow, the genetics here, you're just in awe of. And I don't know that I have that feeling with David Tua. Like, Tua just looks like a really strong – I trained with a couple of twin brothers who were Samoan, and they were kind of like Tua. Whenever they weren't fighting, they were 280 pounds. And then when they were fighting in amateurs, they were light heavyweights. And I was like, you guys have done this for 5 years and had 50 fights where you're constantly – losing and gaining 60, 70 pounds. Like, that's just amazing to me how your organs must be responding to that kind of extreme weight loss. And probably that was similar for Tua.
Well, and yeah, there's so many things that can do to your body. That's just not good. You know, your body feels the strain of that for sure. Everything in your brain feels the strain of that. So I can't imagine the toll that it would take doing that for long term. But, you know, that's also part of the larger conversation of the hydration, dehydration cycle of losing weight for combat sports. That is, well, anyway, like I said, almost its own conversation. But actually what kind of strikes me, and I'm sure you've kind of touched on this a few times, and I'm sure you've seen these parallels, especially with your affinity for Cuba and Cuban boxing. But so David Tua actually was born and grew up as a kid on one of the smallest islands in Western Samoa of a population of like 200, you know, very small island. But then his dad had traveled to Auckland, New Zealand, and just recognized that there would be more opportunities there and that it would be a better place for his kids to get educated. So they moved to Auckland, and for anybody, you know, unfamiliar and what's Auckland or what's Auckland like, not to oversimplify it, not to overgeneralize, but if anybody's ever seen that movie, Once Were Warriors, that took place in Auckland, New Zealand slums, you know, Jake the Mus, you know, that movie. And it's a brutal movie, and it's obviously about the very rough life in the Auckland slums. And that's not to say that that's specifically where David Tua was raised or anything, because I don't know that much about it. But it sounds like he probably was not raised in the super, extravagant part of town. because part of that whole his dad putting him in the ring with grown men type of thing was apparently out in front of a shop that his dad owned, and that to me does not sound like they're having a owning a shop with fights out in front of it in an affluent area. So Auckland is a pretty rough place for real. In Oceania, as it were, Auckland is definitely one of the roughest places in terms of crime and in terms of gangs and gang life. And this is where David Tua grew up. And I mean, not to kind of reach too hard here, but a number of the fighters who came from Cuba also grew up in some pretty slum-like areas and came from rough areas. And also on top of that, I think that the parallel that I'm thinking in my head is just that you see a lot of these, a lot of Cuban fighters coming from a place where they're kind of plucked from somewhere, put into a different situation that is really something alien to them, and then expected to be able to cope. But then when they can't cope and don't cope, inevitably the reaction is like, oh, well, look at this piece of shit, or, oh, well, look at this fucking guy, you know, you can't hack it. Whereas I'm not sure we're fully appreciating that kind of shell shock and that the shock that comes, you know, the culture shock, I guess, that comes with that kind of displacement, especially as a fighter and somebody taking shots to the head. And again, I don't want to reach too hard here, but I mean, am I reaching too hard drawing the parallels between these kinds of situations?
No, I don't think so. I mean, almost all of the great Cuban boxers that I was interviewing, you know, when I wrote the Domino Diaries or A Cuban Boxer's Journey about Rigan Diao, they all came from the eastern part of the island, which was by far much poorer. I mean, anything rural, I mean, the joke amongst Cubans was there's Havana and then there's forest. Like, they were tremendously dismissive of those people. And, you know, Rigan Diao, I think, came from a family of nine on a coffee plantation. Felix Sabon used to apparently shadowbox facing Guantanamo Bay, like angrily shadowboxing, waiting to find Americans to knock out in the ring in revenge for this annex prison colony, you know, torture camp and that kind of thing. There are lots of stories of that, but they all came from very, very poor circumstances. And it was considered like a massive achievement for them to make it to Havana to be given, like, by American standards, like a shitty half of a duplex, or to be given Casamayor, Yoel Casamayor, for winning the Olympic gold medal, was given like a Chinese bicycle. You know, that was his big reward from the government. So
I didn't even know that. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, which was like, he cited as a major reason why he left, is he's just like, what the fuck is this? Like, if I'm the best in the world at a sport which the whole world loves and I could be making millions of dollars and this is what it's worth to Fidel Castro, go fuck yourself. Like, I'm going to take my chances in the U.S. And yet when they make it to the U.S., like, I've seen Casamayor at several of Rigan Diao's fights and sort of talked to him. And it's fascinating also, after he loses, let's say, $10 million as a professional, I don't know for a fact he earned that much, but he had some big fights and made some money, to having nothing, except has nothing in the U.S. where there's a lot of bills to pay, which he wouldn't have to pay if he was still in Cuba. And, you know, that we never hear anybody disparage our system for assisting him in having all his money stolen, taken, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you're right in the sense of a lot of these guys that are certainly not being educated in financial literacy, being thrust into capitalism's ultimate black box, which is professional boxing, when they lose everything and they're fucked up and they're beaten and they're damaged, we go, it's all their fault. But as they're on the way up making it, everybody is seeking to gain credit for steering them the right way, and on and on and on. It's sort of the Teddy Atlas thing. You know, while we're winning, it's really me steering you. As soon as we lose, you lost. And several of Atlas's fighters pointed that out, Shannon Briggs among them. It's we while we're winning, and it's you when you lose. And it worked out really well for Teddy Atlas. I don't know how well it worked out for most of the fighters under him. And that's a common thing with a lot of these people from troubled you know, damaging and damaged backgrounds who get their shot, get their window of opportunity. And if things don't work out too well, even when they do work out too well, this is not a sport that is really renowned for producing happy endings for participants.
Well, and yeah. And I mean, I think you kind of got what I was kind of poking at, and that, yeah, that it's just that I think that when you take a person, any person, out of an environment, generally speaking, and kind of put them in a position that they haven't known before, and that is a totally different kind of hierarchical position and a totally different position of power and different financial position, that it, you know, can produce some kind of wacky results, and that shouldn't be a surprise.
Definitely. No, I mean, all of boxing is wacky. Like, from being in the inside on any level, any of the people I've spoken to on the inside of it, calling fights, managers, promoters, trainers, periphery, like, it's wacky as fuck. It's wacky people involved in a wacky environment that is generating occasionally stupidly insane amounts of money. And, you know, it's an ego trip for a lot of people, and you're dealing with a lot of really damaged people. I mean, I brought this up to you before, but like visiting Freddie Roach at Wildcard when Manny was at his peak was quite a thing. Like, it was quite a hub in Los Angeles for like all walks of life to show up. He was just inundated with, it was an event just for Manny to pull up in his Mercedes and train for the day, even when there wasn't a big fight, to when all of his major fighters had lost. Almost everybody that was sort of like family to Freddie in that gym had been thrown out for one problem or another, many of them bordering on sort of criminal encroachment of other people. You know, I don't really want to get into exactly the particulars of it, but I just remember it was not the most stable environment for a lot of people. And when things were going well and it was kind of a gravy train, it was one thing. When all the money had kind of dried up, like, it was a very sad, depressing place. And a lot of people had been banned for life by Freddie, who he seemed very, very close with. And it just seemed emblematic of like an ecosystem that is pretty zero sum for a lot of the people involved. And it's very easy to become delusional about how long the good times are going to go. And for very few people, do they really persist for a long period of time, because it's an environment that's drawing in unstable people. Who the hell wants to get into a business where you're getting your head kicked in and losing most of your money while you're doing it to all the people involved with you? I mean, how many of these great fighters left broke? You can only imagine less protected people, how well they fare, which we don't really hear very much about. So, yeah, I mean, and I don't know, I have no idea what that was like for Tua in, you know, the New Zealand system. There's definitely been some notable fighters who've emerged from over there and Australia, but it's not exactly a hub the way, you know, Detroit, New York, LA, Vegas has produced a lot of fighters consistently. Mexico, Puerto Rico, Cuba, you know, there's just not the infrastructure there for the big time. So I would imagine a lot of the people around Tua, it was a pretty new thing to be showing up in Vegas, being dangled multi-million dollar paydays. Who knows, like, how well they were handling a lot of the, you know, the business side of things and maintaining the necessary discipline of keeping their horse ready for races. I suspect it was not the most well-oiled machine.
Well, and also on a kind of at least somewhat similar note, where Tua grew up in Auckland, he had, like, I think it was 4 brothers, 4 sisters, and then like 10 to 12 other family members living with them. So, I mean, I guess that's just another way in which you know, you look at the, not everybody in Cuba, but often, and I remember reading this too, and this is something you have had brought up, that article by Patrick, I think it was it Patrick Myler, about Kid Chocolate, I want to say. I can't remember who exactly it was, but it was, nonetheless, it was a great article about visiting the old, you know, the original Kid Chocolate as he was more or less on his deathbed in an old decaying kind of Spanish-style hacienda-like house that was common in the just a decaying old nice house that had just fallen to shit was apparently common for a family to have settled in a number of the Cuban slums. And that's pretty much what we were looking at. And I can't say much about the decay in terms of where they were in Auckland or anything like that, but just the idea of, you know, culturally spending that much time with that many family members in a house and stuff like that, and ostensibly having to support that many family members at some point if you become famous, is that's something too.
Yeah, that, and that article you were referring to was Jonathan Rendell, the late Jonathan Rendell.
Yes,
I think he wrote it for Ring Magazine, and it's collected in one of the best boxing books I've ever read. This Bloody Mary is the Last Thing I Own. And, yeah, it's one of the – it's up there. It's one of the best boxing profiles I've ever read.
No, Rendell – I should have known that because Rendell is a really incredible writer.
He is.
But that article, it's somewhere online if anybody wants to look it up to see what we're talking about. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but if you look up Kid Chocolate and Jonathan Rendell, it'll pop up somewhere. Really, really great, but also kind of like sobering article. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I think that where David Tua's journey led to, I mean, it's definitely better than a lot of fighters who were in his position and whatnot. But the last that I heard, I don't know what he's looking like these days, but the last that I saw and heard, he operates a gym in New Zealand that is aimed specifically toward people who are like losing large amounts of weight and having to do it somewhat like stationary. And he uses boxing to help people work out. Like, he might be doing something slightly different now, but that's the last that I saw. But also the last that I saw, he had gained quite a bit of weight.
Hmm. Yeah, he looks huge. He looks like King Koopa, to throw in a Super Mario Brothers reference. But yeah, he's gigantic. I mean, he just looks like somebody who's meant to be 350 pounds. Like, genetically, there's a yearning to be massive. He kind of always had that.
Jason, he's just a big dude. Large head, you know, just large frame. He's big. So I think that, yeah, if we're talking about destiny, he was probably always destined to just be a large human being. But anyway, at least in terms of his faculties, it sounds like he's all right. Sounds like financially he's doing okay. Funny thing that I actually remembered and that I forgot to bring up a little earlier on the show, in probably 2000, back when I was talking about like all the, you know, message board stuff and all of that, right around that time, a number of fighters were coming out with their own websites and things. And I mean, I think that there were a lot of fighters who had managers and promoters and advisors who were forward-thinking in the sense that they understood that a lot of things were going to be online. And dude, I mean, no disrespect to Ring Magazine, but Ring Magazine had almost fucking zero online presence to like the mid-2000s, dude. Like, that's just makes no sense. And so, you know, a lot of these institutions were just really slow to come around to it. But a handful of fighters, you know, had, like I said, probably had managers who got it. And David Tua was apparently one, because David Tua had his own website and his own logo and a mailing list that I belonged to. And another one was Kosh Gazoo, Costazoo had his own website and logo and mailing list that I belonged to and shit. So anyway, I just remember that and remember David Tua kind of just being, you know, close to my heart for that reason in my formative years.
Well, I hoped, I mean, sometimes there's these fighters when you're following them in real time and there's a sense of, you know, like you said, like Tua Tyson could have changed the complexion of his career completely. Like, I mean, how much money would he have made for that fight? I'm sure he made some big money. I mean, he fought Maskayev. He fought, you know, the John Ruiz fight. I mean, I guess that was early in his career. Lewis, he must have made a few million for. But if he beat somebody like Mike Tyson in 1999, where could Tua have gone? Tua could have become like a major draw sort of thing. It's interesting because he never really was a major draw. He was the sort of guy that I think casual boxing fans would see and be the moment you'd watch him, you'd go, this guy's really exciting. But I don't know that he really got the necessary exposure to casual fans. I still don't think casual fans really have any idea who he was, because I don't think like Lennox Lewis drew fans to him. But a Tyson fight would have. You know, I don't think there was enough overlap with his career to have gotten Foreman, but there's some interest. You know, we're talking a pretty big window that his career encompassed, where there was a lot of fun guys for him to fight. He did fight a lot of fun guys, some great results, but I still think he's one of those people where there's a lot of what ifs in terms of the best possible version of Tua. If that was a more consistent theme and who he fought against, we see that nobody stopped him. I think he was only dropped once, like at the end of his career, where he was really heavy. And there's like a hilarious YouTube video of the guy who dropped him, and it's set up like it's like a Rocky moment for the guy who did it, like that nobody will ever hear from ever again for anything he's ever done. But Tua had some real potential to be quite a special fighter. And I think, I mean, I'm not saying a great fighter, but a very good, dangerous fighter that could have had some pretty big upsets. And had Tyson been on his resume, especially in 1999, where we're still really close to the Evander Holyfield losses, interesting. Interesting where he might have ended up in some sort of alternate universe, I think, because he definitely showed flashes of somebody as watchable as in terms of being an exciting action fighter that boxing has ever produced, and in a very unlikely sort of product. Like when you look at him, you wouldn't, I think, immediately say that guy is going to knock out John Ruiz in 10 seconds. But, you know, did some amazing things.
No question. And funnily enough, again, looking back, doing some of the research and stuff like that, another funny thing that I had noticed was that earlier on in his career, he had done an interview, and Kevin Barry was with him. And when they spoke with Kevin Barry, they were asking Kevin Barry, what's the plan? Who are you guys going to go after? And Kevin Barry kept mentioning Holyfield. So it sounded like, almost to me, like Kevin Barry had been haunted by that, you know, the quote-unquote victory over Evander Holyfield, and for whatever reason wanted his fighter, David Tua, to write it for him. I found that just intriguing. But another thing that I found intriguing, and I guess this is probably the last thing that I got, I swear, and that I don't know, I'm just maybe trying to wedge this into the conversation because I found it, and I personally found it intriguing. At one point, David Tua was just massive in terms of popularity in Samoa. It makes sense. There aren't a ton of Samoan fighters, you know, fighters who have come out of Samoa. And there are a lot of athletes, but probably not many who have gravitated toward boxing to any famous degree. And so in the lead-up to his title shot against Lennox Lewis, apparently David Tua had petitioned one of the leaders, one of the kind of spiritual leaders of Samoa, to allow everybody on the islands to wear these special, like, magical ceremonial beads. And so I don't know why, but for whatever reason, I thought, like, oh, I've never heard of that, so I want to know more about that. What's going on with these Samoan beads? And I couldn't really find much. I figured there would be, like, a Wikipedia page or something, but no, there's no Wikipedia page. So, of course, I had to take it back to Amazon Books. Or, not Amazon Books, but Google Books. And I wound up finding a book that was entitled First Contacts in Polynesia, the Samoan Case, 1722 to 1848. Okay, I know, I'm sorry, but I really am doing this. So apparently in the 1600s, Tongans had come into contact with Europeans, and in contacting Europeans had traded some objects with Europeans, and many of them were beads, like glass beads and other beads that they had no access to or had, you know, not gotten or whatever before. And so the Tongans had apparently traded with the Samoans, and so the Samoans had a number of these beads. Apparently in 1791, there was some sort of contact between some Europeans and some Samoans, in which the Europeans just for no reason fired on the Samoans and shot a bunch of them. And then for whatever reason felt really bad about that and then took their boat over to these Samoans they had just shot, and to the survivors gave them a bunch of beads. And so culturally, a number of anthropologists believe, and they apparently later confirmed, that Samoans believed at the time that these beads were life-saving beads, and that these strange, you know, white creatures that they had not really seen before and only heard of shot a bunch of shit at them and then gave them a bunch of beads. And so culturally these beads came to be important and came to be known as life-giving beads, and beads that would be given to guests and honored people and spiritual people on islands. So feel free to correct me if I'm totally fucking that up, anybody, and I'm sorry, but this is at least what I'm reading in these books. So I found that eminently intriguing for whatever reason, that had carried all the way over into the story of a fighter challenging for the heavyweight title that was raised in Samoa.
It was, I mean, you and I have talked about it many times, but like one of the things I love about boxing is you get these characters. I mean, how many people do you know who've traveled to New Zealand? Like, I don't know many, and every person I've ever met from New Zealand, like a common trait, is they're all super interesting, funny, charming, bright, curious people. Like every time I meet them, I'm like, I want to know more of these kind of people. And it was really fun for a little brief period in time that every time you could meet them, one commonality is you could talk about David Tua being this great fighter from New Zealand. And they all totally knew who he was because of what he represented over there as somebody who had left there and was on the world stage. I mean, Russell Crowe left New Zealand when he was 3 years old. And yet every time they talked about Russell Crowe, it's like, here's this New Zealander and all that, you know, South Park does it. I'm from Auckland or, you know, Wellington or whatever. And it was like, he really wasn't. Like, he left at 3 years old. He was fucking Australian more than anything. But Tua had this wonderful quality of making the exotic for people that are just completely ignorant to his background really fun, intriguing, and exciting. And he was a good interview after fights. Like, he seemed like a really cool guy, and the team around him was really cool. And I always like when boxing does that, like introduces to an audience, not in a way like professional wrestling. It was kind of the opposite in that it was throwing fire on nasty stereotypes about other cultures, right? Like, it was very demeaning, you know, to have Tatanka be an emblem of Native Americans was absurd, right? Like, it was just so patently offensive. But boxing, you got kind of an unfiltered version of it, like as you say, where it was just like, who is this guy? Where does he come from? And when you're a little kid learning about it, it was just like, this is very interesting and I want to learn more. And it fosters curiosity and a sense of, wow, like this is the best boxing version from that culture. Plus he seems like a very nice person. And to know from these brief exchanges that we have with him when HBO brings him to my home on television kind of thing. So I've always loved that boxing does that. I mean, it's what totally was a gateway drug into Cuba was, what the fuck are these Cubans doing that they say no to money? I don't get that. Like how could anybody say no to money? My whole system is about selling out at the first opportunity. Like what's wrong? Are they all crazy? That was my sense of it. And then you meet them and it's like, they don't look like Ivan Drago and what communism represents from Russia. Like they don't line up with that, with the way Stallone presented communism, which I fully bought into as like a 6-year-old or whatever. So I think like boxing does have the power to combat ignorant stereotypes about groups because you're meeting real people in a kind of unmitigated, unfiltered way. And Tua was a fun way to have an emissary from a culture that seemed, I totally wanted to learn more about it. Like you're saying, like it's a super interesting culture.
Definitely very interesting. And I guess a quick shout out to, I did take a cultural anthropology course with an instructor named Leilani Holmes, who is from Polynesia, is from Hawaii, and learned about that shit there. And that really, I think, fostered my interest in cultures and anthropology and stuff like that. But anyway, I guess it kind of brings us to a close, but I will say that doing a David Tua episode was a good idea because I wouldn't have thought to do that. And yeah, I learned a bunch of stuff I did not know before. And now I kind of want to go over to YouTube and watch as many David Tua fights as I can because we're not fucking going anywhere, people. So let's go watch that shit.
No. Well, and if you're going to shout out, I'm going to shout out Bill and Rob Druitt, who were twin Samoans, who I used to regularly spar with when I was 16, and they were like 5 years older than me, and they used to beat the fucking shit out of me, and they were the nicest people I ever met in boxing. And I just thought, I don't think I want to do this with more people that are like these guys and they're twins. Ugh. And I don't want to fight any more Samoans. They're just much, much, much better than I am. But they also just love David Tua, so.
Well, hopefully that means that this episode was much, much better than the regular episode. But in any event, everybody who listened in today or who listens in later on, we do wind up appreciating it in one way or another. And also, if you are on Twitter, do us a favor. Follow Bryn Jonathan Butler there at Brynicio, Brynicio. And also follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. Throw it a like. And the last thing is, whatever podcasting app that you're using, whatever you're listening to this episode on, if you wouldn't mind giving us a rating, subscribing to the show, telling your friends, relatives, pets, all of those things, not coworkers, because you're probably not going to work right now, but everybody you can, tell us about it. Appreciate it. Are you still there, man? Still there, man?
Still here.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Well, thank you, man. Much appreciated, and I'll talk to you soon, bro.
Yeah, let's do it again soon. I think people could use a little bit of distraction from this shit.
Definitely going to be doing more diversions in the coming weeks, so we'll see where it goes. All right, everybody. Thanks so much.
Yep, take care, everyone. This sucks. So, yeah.
Take it easier, buddy.